In light of the Old Testament reading for today, I think it's interesting that one of the first games we learn to play as a young child is hide-and-seek. Little babies learn very quickly a simple version of this game in peekaboo. You know, when you take the blanket and you put it over their eyes and then you quickly pull away and say, peek, it's fun to see their eyes light up and the big smile that covers their face. And as they get older, it transforms into them doing the hiding, just hoping for mom and dad or maybe grandma or grandpa to hurry and come and find them. You know, Penny likes to hide on the other side of grandma and grandpa's bed, even though she knows she's not supposed to go over there. You know, hiding's not really the problem. It's the mischief that she gets into while she's over there hiding that's the problem. But she also has the funniest take on saying boo. It's not boo, but ba, like a little sheep. But, you know, it isn't really that often that we think of our relationship with God in terms of a game. And yet, there is that sense in which we do play a game that started way back in the Garden of Eden, the game of hide-and-seek. To lay a little groundwork right before these passages in our Old Testament lesson for today, we have the creation of the world in 6 days. Each day ended with, and God saw that it was good. And on the seventh day, God rested from his work and made the seventh day holy, a day of rest. But in the third chapter of Genesis, the tone changes. Sin enters into the world through the serpent and the disobedience of man and woman. We typically label this chapter the fall, as it is the fall of mankind into sin. Pardon me. Having eaten of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, Adam and Eve's eyes were open, their innocent loss forever. Death has come into the world, a consequence of sin. They now realize that they are naked, and they make a covering for themselves out of fig leaves. It is here that our Old Testament lesson for today begins. In the text, we find Adam and Eve hiding from God, fearing God because of their sin. God comes looking for Adam, saying, "Where are you?" The fact that God is seeking after Adam is a sign of God's grace. You see, it's not like God didn't know exactly where Adam was. And this is where the game of hide-and-seek between mankind and God begins. In the Garden of Eden, Adam, who represents us all, hides in fear from God. Adam hides because of his sin and the guilt that goes along with sin. Sin and guilt made Adam and Eve fear God. So they hide from him, hoping God will not find them, fearing his wrath at their wrongdoing. But Satan isn't quite finished yet with the damage he wants to inflict on mankind. Satan tries to exploit this fear of God. You know, a certain amount of guilt is healthy and beneficial in making us aware of our need for God and of his grace and forgiveness. The trick, however, is for Satan to take this guilt and make it debilitating in one's relationship to God, making the guilty person feel that the situation is hopeless. Satan wants us to think that God could never love a sinner like me. But it is at these times of hide-and-seek when God calls to us, "Where are you?" The question is really for our benefit. God asks the question because in his grace, God seeks us. God calls, "Where are you?" This rhetorical question is not only in a physical sense, but in a spiritual sense as well. Where are you in your relationship with me? God does not abandon us in our sin and guilt any more than he abandoned Adam and Eve in the garden. He seeks us out in love. Even in the beginning, God surrendered his honor and humbled himself in the service of mankind. Like a good shepherd, he came searching for his lost sheep, Adam. What God did for Adam did not depend on Adam's worth, his merit, his works, or his conduct, but solely on the grace of God. Adam and Eve also hide because of their nakedness and the shame that goes along with it. Before the fall into sin, nakedness symbolized human innocence. Adam and Eve had nothing to hide, either from God or from one another. A shadow of this innocence is sometimes seen in small children, who are not ashamed of their bodies, and who think nothing of nakedness. In his book, Faith, Hope, and Hilarity, Dick Van Dyke tells the story of a Catholic family in Pennsylvania who brought a Protestant neighbor boy along to go wading in Lake Erie with their 6-year-old daughter. The girl decided that the only way to keep her clothes dry were to take them off, and so she did. As she headed toward the water, the boy looked at her and said, "Wow, I didn't know there was that much difference between Protestant and Catholics." Unfortunately, that kind of innocence cannot be replicated in adults. So after the fall into sin, nakedness comes to symbolize human rebellion and alienation from God. The current culture seems to not have that same connection of shame with nakedness. You see it in the way people dress, and you see it in the movies of today. This is not a symptom of righteousness, and it is not something that we should rejoice in. This is not trying to recreate the innocence of the Garden of Eden. The sin of the garden cannot be undone by man. Nakedness has become tainted forever. In the verses that follow our passage, we read that God made clothes for Adam and Eve out of animal skin. This is viewed by some as the first animal sacrifice for sin, a possible foreshadowing of the sacrificial system to come. But God also knew that leaves were not adequate protection for Adam and Eve and for what lay ahead. So he provided for them and showed them how to clothe and protect themselves from the harsh environment to come. It is here again that we see God's mercy as he seeks to provide for a fallen mankind. And then God questions Adam, "Who told you that you were naked? Have you eaten of the tree that I commanded you not to eat?" Again, God didn't need any information. This cross-examination was intended to arouse the necessary guilt and not merely shame. Adam's response at times will make us blush with embarrassment. "The woman whom you gave to be with me, she gave me the fruit and I ate." Adam, hiding his part in the rebellion, twists this to be God and Eve's fault. So God asked Eve, "What is this that you have done?" Eve replies, "The serpent deceived me and I ate." God doesn't even bother to contradict these excuses, which simply adds to Adam and Eve's guilt. Cursed by God, kicked out of the garden, their hiding in sin has reached its fullness. But in this game of hide and seek, it is only man who hides from God. God also hides from man. Indeed, sometimes we speak of the hiddenness of God. The hiddenness of God is a common theme throughout Scripture. The prophet Isaiah writes, "Truly you are a God who hides himself," from Isaiah chapter 45. The psalmist asks, "Why, O Lord, do you stand so far away? Why do you hide yourself in times of trouble?" from Psalm 10. This side of Eden, it is God's turn to hide. And this hiddenness of God means that we only know as much about God as he has chosen to reveal to us. Luther spoke of the hidden God, who totally never reveals himself. God is present only in a hidden way, behind what Luther calls a mask, which hides the true identity of the wearer until the time for unmasking has come. Jesus tells us in John 16, "I still have many things to say to you, but you cannot bear them now." Paul reveals in his first letter to the Corinthians that, "For now we see in a mirror dimly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, then I shall know fully, even as I am fully known." This side of heaven, God reveals as much of himself as we need and as we can handle. And it is because of our limitations as a fallen creation that God hides himself from us and chooses to reveal himself in different ways. John Stinke, author of a book, Preaching the Theology of the Cross, describes it in this way. "The reality of God's grace is hidden under its opposite. Grace is hidden under our sorrow. Compassion is hidden under our grief. Goodness is hidden under our misfortune. Steadfast love is hidden under our shaky fears. Mercy is hidden under our troubles. Peace is hidden under our anxiety. It's no wonder that Luther could brazenly assert, God is known only in suffering. And so also, the first gospel proclamation is hidden in the veil promise of verse 15. I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your offspring and her offspring. He shall bruise your head, and you shall bruise his heel. The battle lines are drawn between the offspring of the woman, Jesus, and the offspring of the serpent, the devil. The devil will strike at the heel of Jesus when Jesus dies on the cross, a painful but temporary wound. But in that death, Christ will crush the devil's head, completely destroying his power. The cross is a symbol of Christ's victory over sin and death. Our clothing now consists in not the flimsy fig leaves of our own righteousness, but in the righteousness of Christ himself. In this game of hide and seek, there's also a paradox. You see, God is not bound by human rules. We see this in that we seek God until he finds us. Let me say that again. We seek God until he finds us. We seek God as people groping in the darkness of sin and suffering. How often in the times of suffering have we asked, where are you, God? It is in the same suffering. It is in the same darkness in which Jesus cried out, my God, why have you forsaken me? Suffering is a kind of darkness that eats away at us until we may even question the very existence of God. Our psalm for today captures this in a very telling way. Out of the depths I cry to you, O Lord. O Lord, hear my voice. Let your ears be attentive to the voice of my pleas for mercy. If you, O Lord, should mark iniquities, O Lord, who could stand? For with you there is forgiveness, that you may be feared. I wait for the Lord. My soul waits. And in his word I hope. My soul waits for the Lord more than a watchman for the morning. More than a watchman for the morning. O Israel, hope in the Lord, for the Lord there is steadfast love, and with him is plentiful redemption, and he will redeem Israel from all his iniquities. David knows that, unlike the game of hide and seek, where the seeker searches and finds, it is in our suffering where we seek God and God finds us. We seek God until he finds us. Luther described this type of hide-and-seek when he writes, the psalm tells you to learn, to listen, and to let it be told to you whenever you are disturbed by various difficulties and by troubles of every kind. Consider that God is playing with you, and that this game is wonderful for you and gives pleasure to God. For if he did not embrace you with a fatherly heart, he would not play with you in this way. Therefore, this is proof of his ineffable mercy toward you, that you are numbered among those with whom God is pleased, and he takes delight in you. Accordingly, he gives you his promise, word, and sacrament, as most certain symbols and testimonies of grace, that he has adopted you as his son, and that he, quote, requires nothing else that you bear his games, which are pleasing to him, and salutary to you. From Luther's Works, Volume 7. And it is in this game of hide and seek that we seek God as people enlightened by the Spirit. God again turns the rules of the game upside down in that it is only when we are found by God first that we seek him. Many Christians have the strange feeling that they finally found God,